She's been on the beat a quarter of a century, writing stories from Miami to Vietnam, later into the mountains of Latin America with a backpack and her bridegroom, and then onto the roadways of that other America's heartland. Tad Bartimus is an AP reporter, currently on leave. She's teaching journalism to students at the University of Alaska Anchorage on this edition of Conversations, An Hour with the Working Press. Tad, thanks for joining me.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
Welcome. I want to go back to a lecture I heard you give where you said, when I went to Vietnam, I was a dewy-eyed girl of 24.
Mm-hmm.
But I knew it was the war of my generation, so I had to be there. How'd you know that?
I grew up in a small town in Missouri, and Life magazine was our window on the world. That and the Kansas City Star. And I had amazing parents who both, from the time I was little, used those at the dinner table. We were penalized if we came to dinner and didn't talk. And because of Honest to God, Life magazine, and the Kansas City Star, and the fact that every day was a current events day, I was always acutely aware of current events. And for some reason, my father had great admiration for the press. Till the day he went in the hospital with his last illness, he read the newspaper front page to back in a very methodical way, every section, every day of his life. And in the days when there were competing newspapers, he read both of them. And so he had great respect for it. And somehow it evolved in my life that I was going to be a journalist. Mm. I remember him telling me a couple of very valuable things, which I think of sometimes with great affection. One was that since we didn't have any money as a family, that the best way to see the world was to get somebody else to pay for it.
Yeah.
And also that I didn't have to become rich myself. I just had to know people who lived in nice places and I could go and visit them a lot. But it was a way for me to go beyond the horizon of where I grew up.
Uh-huh.
And Vietnam was something that came along, I remember as far back as 64, 63, when I was in high school and the Kennedy assassination. I followed it as a way of keeping track of Tom Dooley. I don't know if you are of that generation. We're the same age. But Tom Dooley was a Jesuit priest who went to Laos and was very much involved with orphans there. And I was kind of young and very impressionable in high school, and I got a hold of some of this literature. And I became very affected by that part of the world. And it was the Kennedy era of ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. And this all got wrapped up at an early point in my life. I took it whole cloth, and I believed it. But I also didn't want to just go into the Peace Corps. I wanted to participate in a different kind of arena. And I loved journalism from the time I was little. So I went to work on a weekly newspaper, and from there it was, I'm on my way to Vietnam.
You got to Vietnam at not that it was ever a safe place to be, but an extremely dangerous time, didn't you?
That's true.
The
yeah.
question I have is, did you expect anything that you saw? Did you understand what
no.
you were going to?
No, I didn't have a clue. I mean, you can read Life magazine, and Larry Burroughs was a Life magazine photographer of great renown who came to the University of Missouri when I was a student there and sort of took me under his wing. I corresponded with him. He was killed in Laos in 1971. Mm-hmm. I thought I knew what I was going to do. I'm glad I didn't know, because I might not have gone. But when I got there, this was not a tidy war. No, mm-hmm. wars aren't. And I also had never considered the emotional impact of war on me as a person, let alone me as a journalist. So that was really the shock of it. I mean, I got off the plane and the next day I was old.
Wow. Tad Bartimus with us on Conversations. She was not the first woman to go to Vietnam, but the first woman the Associated Press sent after a great deal of lobbying, personal lobbying, to go.
Well, actually, there were two others, but they went for brief amounts of time. The AP sort of did things in an experimental way. It's the world's largest wire service, and so it tries out things. It doesn't make major snap judgments. And Kelly Smith went before me, and she went for 6 weeks and was confined to Saigon. And then my colleague Edie Lederer, who has now gone on to cover wars, countless wars. I'm sorry to say that there are countless wars, but she's been a terrific war correspondent, went before me and was there for 3 months. And I came and followed her in. And at each juncture, the AP sort of loosened the tight lines that they had kept on us, because after all, we were women, you know, and we had to be protected. And at some point, in my first week in country, all of the rules that had been sent out by New York went into the wastebasket, and my bureau chief on the scene was quite remarkable and wonderful and let me essentially said, you're on your own, kid. You can do anything that the rest of us do. And so I took that as a mandate.
Is that part of what you mean when you say Vietnam made you as a reporter?
Yes. It made me as a reporter in many ways, because it also made me a person. I was sort of this, the Pillsbury dough girl, in the sense that I was pretty unformed, and I'd had a protective environment in which to grow up in a small Midwestern town. And I went to a big AP bureau in Miami straight out of college, and I was safe there. I had mentors, and I was always the girl. It was sort of like poor Mary Tyler Moore, you know. I was the girl in the office, and I got protected. When I got to Vietnam, everybody had their own agenda. In my office, we were always short-staffed, and people were always doubling up. We worked 7 days a week. We often worked 20 hours a day. And so I had to develop who I was as a person, and I had to start shaping my own way as a reporter. And so there I learned to start trusting my own judgments, to start following my instincts, to insist on assignments that I thought I was capable of doing, whether I was or not. And so I gained a lot of freedom there, and I got my first taste of sort of self-directing my life.
Mm-hmm. I may be leaping ahead with this question, but you came into journalism on the tail end of the civil rights movement.
I would say in the middle. Certainly not Brown versus Board of Education, but before Kent State and before an awful lot of things in the civil rights movement.
As feminism was
60, I date that really from 65, 66, mm-hmm. when it burst into my world, which was, again, the small Midwestern rural place. And and I realized right from the time I was small, I had a father that said, you can do anything. And I believed him. And because of the way he was raised by women, which I think I discussed in the class, he was raised by women, and he saw them struggle. And for me, he wanted me to have an education, and he wanted me to believe in myself. And he said, there is nothing that can stop you. And if someone tells you that you are to be stopped, you go around them. You find a way to get around them. Mm-hmm. And so I always believed that. And when I got out of school, history was on my side. So I was sort of barging into the system at a time when the door was already being cracked by women slightly ahead of me saying, we will not take this anymore. Mm-hmm. And there I was.
So things were opening wide for you.
Things were opening. I wouldn't say wide, but I would say they were opening.
This is also a time where I think the, if I can use the phrase, the essential innocence of America was getting its knocks with the assassinations, with the war, with the civil rights movement, with feminism. A lot of illusions were bursting. Did that impact you as you kind of grew through it as a reporter?
I think I recognized about 1966, my sophomore year in college, that I was living in an extraordinary time, in any time in history. It was, by any yardstick, it was extraordinary. And I felt that to be a journalist was to truly have the old cliche. You were, you know, in the front row of history. But I also felt that in many ways, journalism was going to shape it as it came to do in Vietnam. Keep in mind, I was following that story so closely. Mm-hmm. And that's when the backlash against the press began, on the part of people in power and the administration, first Lyndon Johnson and then Richard Nixon. And I recognized that there would be an enormous amount of power wielded by the press, and that this was an incredible time to be a journalist. And I also believed that I could make a difference. I think that was a real motivating element for me. I mean, I felt that I could go to Vietnam and I would write these stories about how unjust it was, and by God, the war would stop. That didn't happen. But I did write stories that no one had really been writing. And for that, I'm very proud of that. I look at them now occasionally and I think they hold up. I wrote about subjects that people covering heated battles didn't really have time to do, nor maybe the inclination to do.
This is Tad Bartimus with us on Conversations. She's visiting Fairbanks as a guest of the University of Alaska Fairbanks Department of Journalism and Broadcasting. She currently is holding the Robert Atwood Endowed Chair at the University of Alaska Anchorage, a chair which is offered to someone felt to be a leading journalist, and will hold that position for 2 years total. She's on leave from the Associated Press, which she served for 24 years. I want to ask you about that perspective. And I think I just want to throw the phrase women's perspective back at you with all the baggage that is loaded onto it and ask you about writing from a woman's point of view. Can you address the baggage and also what you think it really is?
I just see it as opportunity.
Translate that.
As a woman who writes for a major international wire service, I have the chance to bring a really unique perspective. I don't think there's any question. I am a person who believes that women do bring a unique perspective to what they cover. This will get you an argument in basically any bar or any ladies' room that you can go into in the world. But I believe that I have an acute eye for what goes on around me. And I bring to that everything that being a woman also means. I bring to that the fact that I went through all kinds of inequality in pay, that I struggled in journalism school from male professors who said to me, you can't possibly do hard news because there's no room for you in our newsrooms. But we can send you to the women's pages, and I said women's pages be damned. I'm not doing that. So I come from that perspective to begin with. But I also feel, for instance, when I was writing in the Midwest in the 1980s about the farm crisis, and I don't like to lump things, but that's what we called it, and mm-hmm. people can identify with that. It occurred to me, I wasn't particularly writing about farmers who committed suicide. I was writing about their widows who were left with the mess. And nobody done that. I think that's where being a woman in this business, you stop and you think, and if you really give a lot of thought to what you do, which is the first thing I try to bring to my job, it is, what does this really mean and who does it really affect? And I think women tend to do that more, for whatever reason. I certainly see this in my female colleagues. More so than my male colleagues.
That it's the family or the relationship or the impact on the human being that drives the story for
you. It's also picking up the pieces. Who picks up the pieces? Who's left in a war zone to find food for the family, to find water for the children or milk for the children to drink? Who tries to educate the kids while the men are off fighting, but here are children trying to go to school? I mean, I look at some of, the best reporting out of Bosnia increasingly is by women, and we know that. Also, you have the advantage of being able to, given the fact that women are often dismissed as something that's part of the landscape, you have better access frequently to stories that your male colleagues could never get. You can get past roadblocks. I mean, I was getting past all kinds of roadblocks. I actually drove the road in Laos from Vientiane to the old capital of Luang Prabang and arrived in an old beat-up Chevy and with a Lao woman, and we got there and they said, where did you come from? We said, we drove the road, and they said, nobody's driven the road in 18 years.
And, but you were a couple
we just
of
did it.
Girls, so
yeah,
you could
we
get
were,
through.
Well, nobody even looked at us. So really, I mean, I guess they thought I was an aid worker or some crazy round eye. And I found in Northern Ireland, the stories that I wanted to tell in Northern Ireland had to do with this continuing religious conflict where the men tended to be the warriors or the wounded or the dead, but yet the victims clearly were often in these bombings. Women and children out doing shopping in a very traditional society where women and children go into the stores to shop. They were the ones getting blown up, and it was the men on both sides who were planting the bombs. And so I tried to bring that to my reporting in Northern Ireland, and the same when I went to Guatemala.
Women have been in the field increasingly since you went in. Do you notice any impact on journalism as a whole, or are there two voices?
Oh, no, I think it's becoming increasingly integrated in the sense that there are so many women in newsrooms now. Now, of course, it's being called the pink ghetto that we've co-opted it. You can't win for losing sometimes. But I look around at my colleagues who are my age, and I see an incredible difference. I mean, I can look around the country, and there are managing editors of major newspapers throughout the nation who are my contemporaries, who are directing what's to be covered and how it goes into the newspaper. And I think those, I have my own theory, and I have absolutely nothing to back this up with, but I can say it anyway, right? Because I'm a guest on your show.
That's right.
I believe if you look at these newspapers, Pam Johnson in Phoenix, Kathy Hamm in San Bernardino, Tony Katz in Orange County, and you look at those newspapers, you will find that they're healthy and that their circulation is increasing because they are appealing to women who have dropped off enormously in reading American newspapers. And when you have women who contribute in real constructive ways to the content of American newspapers, they're changing them, and the newspapers are back in vogue in those areas. They're being read by women. Totally unsubstantiated theory. But my thinking is that the American media still responds to the bottom line. And if these newspapers being run at the real shirt sleeve level by women weren't making money, these women would be replaced by men. They're not being replaced. They're being promoted.
And you think it's because they have the fingers on some pulse?
Well, I believe it's also because they live more varied experiences. I mean, they're still women with children. Often they are divorced women with children who are major players in American journalism, and they're still arranging daycare at home. They're still doing the grocery shopping. They're still carpooling on the side and still coping with all the things that women have always done. And I believe they bring that kind of perspective and experience to the publications that they put out, and that they're interested in the things that make up real life for a lot of families in all kinds of ways, not just the traditional family. And they're out there. And I still believe that men who, and I don't mean to with a broad brush, I'm not saying that everyone is like this, but I'm saying that of a lot of the men I know in comparable positions in American media sources still live men's lives. They have wives who still do these things. And if there's, and they don't have that experience. They just don't bring that to the newsroom.
Which you would say puts them slightly out of touch.
I think so. I think it throws them off center. And I think that they can compensate for that. I mean, I'm not saying that they should all vacate their chairs and run screaming into the night, but they should be aware that this element is missing, and they should bring people into the mix that come with that experience, and then they should listen to them. And they should let them have real, genuine input mm-hmm. into the product.
Critique the field. You've just said what works in the field from your perspective, and that is somehow the phrase I've used a couple times, fingers on the pulse, knowing what it is that drives and disturbs the American population. What's not working? There are issues that come immediately, red flags popping up in my mind.
You mean social issues in American life?
Or? No, journalists. In your field. Critique the field for me. What's not working and what's working?
I think that people feel increasing, despite the fact that we're in this incredible explosion of technology and information and the buzzwords, the superhighway, information superhighway and all that, I think people feel increasingly disconnected from American life or from community, whatever, however you define that. I think that the fact that a lot of people feel that their car is their next best friend, with the windows rolled up and the air conditioning going and the radio or the headphones, tells them that they're trying to also find a sanctuary from the chaos that's around them. I think that as a society, we are overworked, and we put this off onto ourselves in a lot of cases, where we believe that we must work 60 and 80 hours to get ahead because there's so much competition. And I think we lose sight of the essence of who we are, and then who our spouse is, or our children are, or our certainly our neighbors. You might wave to them as you get the paper in the morning, but do you really know them? Mm-hmm. And I think there's this kind of detachment. And I think that in some ways the media is making it worse, because we're now saying that you can, with 57 channels and maybe nothing on, as Bruce would say, you can surf the dial, and you can pick out what interests you, but you don't expand your interests, you don't make new connections, and we are refining ourselves so in such specific ways that I believe in some ways we're making that worse. And I would like to see newspapers fill the community gap. I think that all this wonderful information on television and radio and cable, that's marvelous, and I can pick and choose the information that distinctly interests me. But I think in all of this great rush to specialize, that the future of newspapers is to become the community connection, mm-hmm. however you define community. And I think that's the trick. And I really believe that diversity in the newsroom, and giving all kinds of people from all kinds of different backgrounds the power over the content and the mix, and having them come together and work this out is the future of American newspapers. And I can only speak for newspapers because that's really all I know. I don't know television. I don't know broadcasting. But I know what I'm seeing on television is that I can go through the channels, and I can be very specific about what I already know that I like, and I'll probably choose that over something that looks maybe kind of interesting, but how much time do I really have? But I think with a newspaper, it can draw me out of myself and into the world of my community and in the world of other people.
Tell me how the Associated Press would fit into that, does fit into that sense of heightening community. The Associated Press is a nationwide vehicle.
Well, I'll tell you a little bit about the AP. It's a cooperative. It's a nonprofit news cooperative. It's headquartered in New York. It's about 150 years old. It has only 4,000 employees, but we have members all around the world, 138 countries or something. And it's just a remarkable resource for the exchange of information, but it still functions in many ways as a family. Hmm. I know that sounds kind of strange, but I have family in Nairobi, and I have family in Bangkok. I have people that I have known for my whole career. I also have the benefit of knowing young people coming in as interns because it's such a small entity. So it's an amazing collection of people. It's becoming more and more diverse all the time. And yet it has access to so much information and so much power that it is a remarkable resource which can be used by media outlets all over the world. It can shrink the feeling of alienation by the information it conveys, but it can also tap into such specialized areas that for somebody who may at some point have access to the AP on their computer at home, it's just an amazing tool. But it also helps guide people who plan what's going to be on the front page of the New York Times. So we can set the agenda for the major news outlets in the whole world, but we can also give you the most interesting little trivia about the Seychelles, if you're interested. It's all there. It's a remarkable resource.
This is why you've stayed with it for 24 years.
I've stayed with it because it was always challenging. There was always room in the AP for me to try new things. Part of that comes from the fact that it was small and it was family-like. And so if I had an idea, I had the ability to present my case to someone who could actually take action and let me do it, but also because of this worldwide connection. And it was also fun. I had a great time. I really had a wonderful time with the AP in those years.
Tad Barnabas went to the University of Missouri School of Journalism, and when she emerged was being courted, recruited by, competed for by different people who wanted to hire her, and she chose the AP from those who were clamoring. Is that too big of a word?
Well, I think so. I you have to keep in mind that those were the days where they were clamoring for anybody. I mean, we were the baby boom generation, and it was 1969 and the explosion of information, and again, the war was taking, there were 1,000 by that time probably correspondents accredited in Vietnam, and who had to fill those holes on American newspapers and radio stations and television stations? Young people coming out of college. But we were also the best trained generation. We were the best educated generation. We were the journalism school generation. And that had not happened before until the baby boomers came out of school. And in those days, I guess they thought, in these hiring gurus thought, well, if they're educated, they're clearly better than the guy who walked in 1952 off the street with a high school education, but he knew the cop shop. Mm-hmm. In some ways, that was true. In other ways, I think maybe we've gone overboard on that somewhat.
Mm-hmm. That was a different skill rather than a better skill.
Exactly.
Yeah. Tad has covered America's stories. Vietnam, we've mentioned. She was in Alaska during the building of the pipeline and for the Exxon Valdez. She covered what we know of as the farm crisis. She's covered fly fishing and breast cancer and been to Latin America during the war, Ireland during the war. As I mentioned before, she's on leave currently from the Associated Press and holds the Atwood Chair of Journalism at the University of Alaska, Anchorage. I want to ask you of the place, I want to ask you about the place of emotions in a journalist's life. And this goes back a little ways to talking about a woman's perspective, but also it asks questions about objectivity. Can you take a hold of any part of that that you want to and move it forward a bit? The question I'm most interested in is the place of your emotional responses to what you see around you.
One of the most influential people in my life was a man who came out of East St. Louis with a 10th grade education, rose from literally the classic front page story of copy boy to managing editor, and then moved on to the University of Missouri and was really in the twilight of his life when I got there in 1965. His name was G. Thomas Duffy, and he was the classic Mr. Grant, Lou Grant. He was hard-boiled. He was very tough. He was a very unemotional person. He actually, I believe, did not think women belonged in the newsroom, but he was accepting the inevitable. And so he was the first person who really believed in me and said to me once, I'm sure in kind of an offhand way, which is why as a teacher I tend not to be as offhand as I might be otherwise, you're going to be a hell of a reporter. But don't cry. God, don't cry. Women can't go out there and cry. You'll ruin the business. And that sort of offhand statement, I admired him greatly, and he helped me a great deal in having enough confidence to go to work for the Associated Press when I was so young and didn't know any better. He said, you can do it, as my father said, you can do it. It may kill you, but you can do it. But the old throwaway line of, for God's sake, don't cry, stuck with me far too long. And I took that and sort of internalized it to mean don't feel. That wasn't what he meant. I like to believe that wasn't what he meant. We never got to have this conversation. But I think he meant don't cry at the scene. Nobody cares how you feel in the middle of some cataclysmic event that is really beyond tears. I don't think he meant don't feel. But because I was young and because I was a woman and always the woman, I took that to mean I had to hide my emotions and that I had to be tough. And I'm not a tough person by nature, I believe. One comes to know themselves over the course of time. And I don't think I was a tough person, but I think I came to put on a veneer that was really callous and cruel for probably even through Vietnam, although it made me very ill, and I essentially had a collapse there. It turns out now that it was caused by, we believe, Agent Orange. And I physically sort of went down to my knees and had a collapse. But one thing that I did do while I was there was one night take an orphan home off the street. And all of my colleagues were saying to me, don't do this. It was a young boy that we had seen around. There were thousands of orphans lived on the street. And he followed me into the office one night. And we had seen him around and given him money and bought him some food. And but I went into the office, he followed me, and my friend who was with me at the time, who worked for ABC, said, don't do it. And I said, well, I'm not going to do it, but maybe I'll just take him home and feed him. I know this sounds like I picked up a stray dog on Cushman, but that's not how I felt at the time. I was so conflicted by the misery that was all around me. So anyway, I took this young man home, and I didn't know how old he was. He could have been 6 to 12. We still don't know. We finally decided he was probably about 9. And he lived with me for 3 months, and I was becoming increasingly ill, and it became apparent that I was not providing him. I was giving him lots of ice cream and lots of money to go to the movies, but a decision had to be made here. I had suddenly meddled in someone's life. So I placed him in an orphanage in Saigon, the Vietnamese American Children's Fund orphanage, until I could figure out what to do, because I was going on assignment in Cambodia. And ultimately, what happened is that I became ill and was medevaced out of the country. He stayed there. I financially supported him there. Then the world imploded, and the country was being overrun by the North. And we had to get him out as well as other people out. And it was a remarkable thing. By then I was in Alaska. I was having a lot of trouble getting him out because he was over 10 years old. We knew that. Mm-hmm. And the government refused to let any male over the age of 10 leave because, of course, they were going to be the last ditch defense of Saigon. They were going to throw these children into the ditches with grenades, and that's how they were going to save the country. So finally, my wonderful, wonderful AP colleagues, this family that I have, managed to get him on a plane. At first we thought he was on the plane that crashed. So we went for about 10 hours thinking that I'd killed him to realizing that he was lost out there in this mass exodus. At the same time, the JCs in Anchorage had organized a flight, of which I had a minor part, and we managed to evacuate all of the children and all of the people out of the orphanage. It was the last flight out of Saigon. It was the absolute last DC-3 that took off out of Saigon. But I lost this child in the mayhem, and for 4 days we didn't know where he was. And he had been so carefully coached by the photographers to say that he had a fake name and a fake ID and not to ever say his name, that when I had AP people frantically trying to find him at Clark in the Philippines and at Hickam in Honolulu. And the AP was just my friends. It wasn't the AP, I hasten to add. It was not the institution, but it was my friends. And they were trying to find this kid. And actually, two of them apparently did, but he lied and said, no, no, that's not me. Mm-hmm. And 10 days later, he turned up in California. And I was called by a man who was a Hollywood producer, David Seltzer, Hollywood director, done quite a few movies. And the only two telephone numbers that Chung had in his pocket were mine and David's. And he wound up in Los Angeles. We still don't know how he got to Los Angeles. He arrived on a commercial flight. And David said, he's with me. And he's been at my house for 3 days. And I bought him a bicycle. And I have a wife and children. And what should I do? And I said, what does he want to do? And he said, he wants to stay. I said, well, of course he wants to stay. He's living in Beverly Hills.
Right. And he has a bicycle.
And I was a single woman still living in Anchorage, Alaska. And so he stayed and grew up with David, and now he's just quite a remarkable young man. Went through college, but I look back on that time as a turning point for me as a person, where it did something, and that changed me. Then I realized it was all right to feel, it was all right to cry, but don't get in the way, and preferably go off someplace and do it by yourself. But it was all right to take some kind of action, and that I had to be a human being first. And a journalist second. Mm-hmm. That's a very long story. I'm sorry.
No, that's fine. This is Tad Partimus. As of 1975, Tad was the first woman in Associated Press history to head a domestic bureau. She was appointed Chief of Bureau for Alaska. She was also the first to join the elite corps of AP writers that's known as Special Correspondents, the first to win the AP Top Performance Award, and the first to be a finalist for two Pulitzers, a woman making her mark in the field and within the Associated Press. Tad was named Associated Press Special Correspondent in 1990, assigned as a roving correspondent for the seven Great Plains and Rocky Mountain states. She's with us in Alaska for 2 years. When did that two-year period start?
It started last fall. My husband is in graduate school.
At UAA.
At UAA, mm-hmm. And he's back in school at the age of 52. And loves it, and he's going to be getting his master's in fine arts, and then we don't know what we're going to do. He loves it so much, and he's so happy to be back here, and actually so am I, that we've decided to defer all decisions until he gets his MFA in May of 95, and then we'll take a deep breath and decide what's next.
Make a decision.
Yeah.
Tad Bartimus' husband is Dean Werner. Listeners may remember Dean was the editor for the Fairbanks Daily News Miner for a while, and this is how the two of them met.
Yes, he was here for 10 years in Fairbanks, the late 60s.
I mentioned in my open that she took a backpack and a bridegroom to the mountains of Latin America. Dean was the bridegroom, and they trekked together through those hills and mountains, looking at the war from the ground level. This is something that you have learned to do since, I assume since Vietnam, is that your stories are on the ground. They're not in the high-rises or the boardrooms.
That's correct. For me, there's less to get in the way. I guess I have a friend who's actually a rock music critic who says that we're such good friends because we're both so suspicious. And at first I kind of felt insulted by that, but then I decided that maybe that wasn't such a bad thing, and certainly not for a reporter. And I feel that the closer I am to the event or the people to whom disservices and atrocities are being done, the closer I am to those people and the more I see with my own eyes, even though I bring to it baggage and my own personal biases. I don't think you can help that as a human being. I'm much more comfortable with that than I am hearing it out of some government official's mouth or some bureaucrat's press release. And so I have increasingly gotten closer to the ground as I've gotten older, and it's where I choose to be.
Mm-hmm. How do you keep those biases out of the story?
No, I do. I try very hard to do that. I keep telling myself that nobody cares what I think, and I believe that. And I also think it's extremely arrogant, as I guess you and I have discussed a little bit, to tell somebody how to think. Mm. I'm very resentful if somebody tries to tell me how to think. And I also decided a long time ago that I can't be a gatekeeper. I can't decide that this side is noble and this side is wrong, because it's never like that. And when I start doing that, I'm being judgmental and I'm being arrogant and I'm doing a disservice to people who have the right to have as much information as they can about, and I don't just say both sides, because I've learned that there's seldom just two sides. There's often three and four and five sides or more. They need information to make up their own mind. Watergate was a wonderful experience for me because I believed that good people came forward in Judge Sirica and Sam Ervin came forward and saved the country, that the system held, that the system worked. And I also believe that from my experience with the war. And I have come to believe that if we let the people truly make their own decisions and don't gatekeep their information, that it may be messy, but in the end it'll be all right. And I've also found this in my foreign reporting, mm-hmm. and I think it's an incredibly arrogant thing for a journalist to do, to try to slant the information.
Do you keep a reader in mind when you're writing?
Well, I used to. I had a wonderful friend who lived next door to me in Miami, and I think about her a lot. We've sort of drifted away from each other, but when I was young, and the only thing she ever read in the newspaper was Ann Landers and her horoscope, and it was a great leveler for me. This happened in my first year of full-time reporting, and I would persuade her to read my stories because I figured that she didn't know a damn thing about the newspaper and the news. But if she thought it was interesting, it was probably pretty good. And if she said, I don't understand it, it was probably pretty bad. And so I sort of try to look for her equivalent in every place I live. And I try to find somebody who isn't interested in the newspaper and isn't interested in the news. And I also try to listen to them to see what's on their mind, because I might be missing something. So as far as do I have one particular person? No, but I sort of have this conglomerate person.
If you want anything of me or of her when we're done reading that article, what is that?
I want them to have learned something, and I want them to remember it. I want it to affect them in the way that they go on somehow. When I was doing the breast cancer series, I wanted people to have a face and a name and an experience to put to something that's just kind of a headline. I wanted them to realize that it could affect them. I believe that all news ultimately affects everybody. I mean, no one knows when they're going to be on the freeway and there's an accident or an earthquake or an attack at a 7-Eleven or a blizzard and they're stuck in it. I believe that people have to be aware of what goes on around them in order to live lives in which they contribute and also in which they're informed and in which their children are educated. So I want them to be affected by what I write in some way, that they carry that with them and that it helps them at some point make a judgment.
You're listening to Tad Bartimus and we're talking on Conversations. I'm thinking of the story that affected me the most. I don't know whether this is, well, it doesn't matter. I couldn't stop myself from crying, reading about the three boys. They were brothers from Missouri. They were 9, 11, and 12. One fell through the ice. The other tried to save him and went down. And the third, each of them having heard from their parents all their lives that you can't just stand aside. The third jumped in to save his brothers, and they all died. You opened that story with a line that had me in tears before I got to the end of five words. There is so little left. It seemed to me that in those five words was the entire story. I went on to read the pages of it, but it was all there. Did that come out of your intellect, your experience, your emotions, do you know where that came from?
Yeah, I do. I know this story so intimately because it was such a turning point for my life. That phrase was echoing in my head. I made myself think and feel through that whole experience of reporting. And I made myself sit on the Greg's couch, and I made myself look. I had asked to look at their scrapbooks and at their rooms. I wanted to see where they lived. I knew that nothing had probably been changed, and I wanted to see their pictures. And I also realized that the parents were in such grief that they weren't talking to each other, and that the father was not having much to do with me. He had said hello and then left me. But the mother was in such a state that I said, I wanted to say to her, let me know about your children. Talk to me about your children. Because what else was I going to talk about? What else was consuming her life? Mm-hmm. And so she got out the things that mothers get out, which were handmade Valentines and report cards and Mother's Day cards and clay projects and old hula hoops. And we spread it out all over the floor, and we sat in the floor. And I made myself look at it and say, this is it. We'll never hear them again. The dog was sitting there sniffing at all these things. The dog was totally lost. The dog was, I tried to focus on anything but this woman's face, and I kept looking at the dog because the dog was waiting. It sat with perpetually cocked ears, waiting. Where's the sound? And I made myself think, this is it. There's nothing else left, and there's so little here. And I knew. Sometimes you know. And I think as a writer, it's real important to know that you know and to say, this is not going to change here. This is what you have to write. There's this inner voice saying, this is what you write. Don't write anything else. And if you trust that and follow that, it will guide you through this incredible landmine.
Why do this story when there is so much criticism of the press, the media, for invading people's lives at times of grief, the inevitable microphone shoved up in the grieving widow's face? How do you feel about why do that story?
It was a very personal thing for me. I came to a personal decision about this. I never see myself as the media. And maybe that is an arrogance. I think we all have an arrogance, and perhaps that's mine. I just see myself as a person working alone. I've never even seen myself as someone competing. Although people say that I am extremely competitive on a story, I always feel like I'm competing with myself. I will get my version, and I will do my job the best way I can. For me, this was a very personal decision, and my husband helped me enormously. My husband is very smart and very caring, and he said to me when I was about to demand that I not be sent on this assignment.
Because the AP called and said.
The AP called and said to me, you must do this piece. We think that there's something else. We'd like you to go there and take a look at the town and talk about the aftermath. And I thought, that's outrageous. I can't do this. But I also was thinking in a very personal way, I can't do this. You can't ask this of me. This is more than I can bear. And my husband said he read the 300-word story that the AP had run on the wire about the funeral, the death and the funeral. And he said, I don't know anything about these children. Who were these children? Is this all we're ever going to know? They'll never laugh again. They'll never play football. They'll never graduate. They'll never get married. Who were these children? All I know is that they died in this incredibly horrible way. Why don't I know about these children? And why won't you go there and help me remember them as they were? And that's why I did the story. And you're right. People were furious at me when I would knock on their door. I was part of the media and the intrusion. And I felt that my best defense was an honest one. I just said, you don't have to talk to me. I'm not demanding that you talk to me. I also have a policy that if someone doesn't want to talk to me, then why waste either of our times? But I want to know who these children are, and maybe you can help me. And they did. And so that's why I did it. I don't believe in... I don't go up to ask people, how do you feel? It's the question, it's the one question I never ask. I'm appalled, as most people are, with this wham-bam, quick and dirty, shove the mic in your face, how do you feel, and race off down the freeway. And I don't practice journalism like that, and I don't think you have to practice journalism like that, and I actually don't think that's journalism. But I do it my way, and if it's not acceptable, then I'll take a hike and go someplace else.
And this other perspective that comes out of that kind of storytelling is part of this community.
The fact, we can't ignore, this is the human condition.
Yeah.
This event happened. This is like people that say, how dare you upset me with pictures on the front page of my newspaper of children in Bosnia lying in their own blood, because this is life. Mm-hmm. And not looking at it doesn't mean that it's not happening. But this kind of invasive, gratuitous violence that I think my profession occasionally indulges in. And I also think my line is a lot farther along than the general public's line. I mean, this is unpleasant stuff to have to deal with. And I think the media is also very much being criticized. It all gets jumbled. We criticize them for the for trivializing Donald Trump's wedding at the Plaza. We equate that with breast cancer stories. We run them the same length in the newspaper. We put them in the same publication. We tend to run them sometimes side by side. I think people have trouble mm-hmm. deciding, should I be upset about this or should I be upset about this? And why are they together and why is it all mixed up? And this is entertainment, where entertainment and education tend to have a big collision.
Do you think that the press, the media, is going to recover from this Donald Trump and breast cancer?
I think that there will always be this parallel track.
Uh-huh.
And I think we'll always have people who are described as journalists at every point in the spectrum. And I believe that there's going to be a market for it. There will be interest in it. But I want to practice one kind of journalism. And if somebody else wants to practice another kind, that's fine. But don't equate the way I do it and my own value system mm-hmm. with somebody else's. I don't think that's fair. And I also think it's kind of lazy on the part of the public to not differentiate and to use that as a really good excuse for not being educated and informed. It's real easy to blame somebody else for not taking your own action. And I say to people, if you don't like your local newspaper, go to the library and read the New York Times or read The Economist or get yourself informed another way. Don't just tell me that television news is terrible. Mm-hmm. Find some other way to do it.
This is Tad Bartimus. The story we're talking about, Band of Brothers, was one of two stories that has been nominated for the Pulitzer. The second was a reflection on the death of her father as her father was dying by cancer and her dealing with that. Both those stories nominated for the Pulitzer Prize. Tad Bartimus is our guest today on Conversations. Kind of a residual to that discussion, is the press tough enough to take all the mud that's going to come at it for these dual tracks of?
Well, I tell my students that, and I tell my colleagues, my young colleagues, who look at me and say, when you came into the business, was on the heels of Woodstein, and everybody was a hero. Now we're all goats. And I say, it swings. If you want to be popular, don't go into this business. If you're thin-skinned, don't go into this business. Because essentially what you do as a journalist is stick your nose into other people's business, and most of the time they don't want it there. Mm-hmm. So you're not going to be a popular person, but is popular what you really want? I don't particularly. I don't want to be part of the in crowd. I just want to do honest work and have a decent life and be fairly productive and write a book or two and sing a song or two. And mm-hmm. And I've never really felt the need to be accepted or legitimate. And also, I'm not in management. So that tells you a lot about
yes
the direction I've chosen to take it with my life.
Still the working press.
Yes.
You mentioned a book. There is one book out, and I expect there's one or more on the way. Boy, is that like pregnancy? I don't know. The book is Trinity.
It is.
Yes. The book is Trinity's Children, subtitled Living Along America's Nuclear Highway. It was co-written by Tad with fellow AP journalist Scott McCartney.
Now at the Wall Street Journal.
Published by Harcourt Brace Jovanovich in 1992. Trinity's Children is about the people who have lived along the nuclear highway from Las Cruces to Buffalo, Wyoming.
Yes.
All right. And takes a very even-handed look at 25 years of atomic focus in that part of the world. Trinity's Children, available at bookstores and libraries. Tad also mentioned another part of her life. She is a singer in a rock and roll band. It's called the Rock Bottom Remainders. Some of the other members include, you'll never have guessed this, Stephen King, Amy Tan, Dave Barry, Robert Fulghum, Barbara Kingsolver, Michael Doris, and his wife,
Louise bowed out.
Oh, did she?
Louise Erdrich. Louise is home writing books and taking care of the kids and not making a fool of herself.
Right. And they sing rock and roll. I understand that you pride yourself on singing it badly. No, this can't be true.
Well, we started out singing it badly, but I guess we didn't know any better.
Getting better now.
We are getting better now. It's very scary. Because at some point, we can't get too good or they'll start reviewing us as musicians and then they'll clobber us.
Then that would be no good.
We've had one review from Don Henley, formerly of the Eagles, now of Walden Pond. And he said we were just lousy and we loved him for it. We made him an honorary remainder.
Good.
But it's a great experience for me. I lived a very narrow life. I was a journalist and my life was my work. My work was my life. And I was a very serious person. And I thought that I had to be a very serious person. And then I got into this band and I found out that these are very accomplished people who aren't particularly serious when they go to have fun. I mean, my fun was serious too. I did educational fun. And they don't do that. We get together, we sort of collide in some place. It's in a few days, I'm going to be in Bangor, Maine, doing a performance for Stephen's favorite charity. And I hasten to add that I'm also in a rock band that doesn't make any money. All the proceeds go to Literacy Volunteers of America and several other charities. And we come together and we rehearse for, depending on our time, either one day or the luxury is having 3 days. And we rehearse very hard. And we have three real musicians in a 17-member band, and they sort of hold us together, and then we perform. And we always perform in places where you can dance. We never perform in concert halls where people have to sit in chairs. And we do sloppy three-chord rock and roll from the 60s. And Stephen plays guitar. Dave Barry is a marvelous musician, even though he will make fun of himself in his column and, of course, on the TV show they do. But he's a wonderful guitar player. And used to have a band called the Federal Ducks.
Hmm.
And Ridley Pearson, who writes thrillers, has a band now in Idaho called the Toast Points. And it's just full of wonderful musicians. Barbara Kingsolver studied classical piano and went to musical conservatory. Amy Tan took classical piano for 16 years, which does not prepare her for doing These Boots Are Made for Walking. But they have become wonderful friends and incredibly supportive of me and have broadened my world a lot.
Here's to having fun.
Oh, it is. It's wonderful.
Yeah. I have a long question to ask you when there are minutes and seconds left. What have you learned from teaching? I'm very interested in this new turn of yours. Is this a good thing?
It's
in
real
your life?
Scary yeah. for me. I have come to believe that I can offer my life experience as a resource. And the one thing that I've decided that I need to get across to them more than anything is they can do anything they decide to do.
Mm, your dad's message.
Absolutely. It's really passing it on. And the other thing is that it's my job to help them try to do that. And I have lived a really kind of extraordinary life for somebody from Belton, Missouri, who used to lay in the grass and wonder what was beyond the wheat field. And I've had this extraordinary life, and I've met fascinating people, and it's now my turn to pay back. And that's what I'm trying to do. And I can't teach them to write. I can only tell them that they must write, because that's how you learn to do it. And then I can try to help them find ways to sell what they write. And that will boost their self-esteem, and they'll just keep going. And my husband says he sees me these days as somebody wearing a voluminous skirt with all these little faces peeking out from the bottom of it as I walk down the hall. And I don't know if I quite feel like a mother hen, but I suppose I look like a mother hen. And
what
it's
an
been
image.
It's been wonderful for me.
Good.
Great.
Tad Bartimus, thanks a lot.
Thank you for having me.
Look for this woman's byline. Look for her on the cover of books. And my goodness, look for her on albums to come, no
doubt. And at the Palladium in May.
This has been Conversations with Tad Bartimus. I'm Susan McGinnis. I hope you join me again next week.